Welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the show this week. My guest is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. We'd love to have your questions for him on our show today. You can call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can send emails to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions to @WBAA News on Twitter. I saw some pictures of you and Mayor Dennis and some others in Washington, D.C., and you alternately looked like you were in a lot of meetings, doing some sightseeing, and very cramped in the backs of cars in all of these social media photos that I saw.
I guess that's a very good way to describe the trips. And we did have a lot of meetings. And sometimes the way Washington's laid out, you do have to take a cab or an Uber. But traditionally, we try to walk quite a bit, quite frankly, if we can, between the meetings. And you get to see different things that way. And so get a little bit of exercise, see some of Washington, D.C. And so we do a little bit of both.
Well, let's start there, because this is an annual trip that you and Mayor Dennis and other county leaders take to talk to some of the federal representatives and talk to Amtrak folks, and we'll get to them in a second. I wanted to get your general takeaways from this year's meeting.
Well, you know, this trip actually started back decades ago, really when railroad relocation started, and it's continued since then, because what we found is that, you know, it's not always easy to meet with your federal legislators or some different agencies out in Washington, D.C. that may have an impact on projects that you're trying to do or funding that you're trying to receive. And so I think what they learned through those early years, that not only for railroad relocation, but for the community in general, that going out there, spending time with your federal legislators, seeing what they're working on, talking to members of their staffs right there in Washington, D.C., and the staffs that are in Washington all the time and kind of in the heat of the battle, for lack of a better word, of what's going on, that's helpful. You get a lot of additional information, maybe some guidance. You kind of get the story of what probably is or isn't going to happen. And so, you know, we have continued to do that, and we go out there with a significant number of issues that we like to discuss, everything from infrastructure, which was a huge topic that we talked about with all of our representatives and our senators, looking at the opioid issue, budgets, tax policy, trade policy. We had a very lengthy meeting with an organization that deals directly with foreign investment in the United States. And as you know, Tippecanoe County has a significant number of industries that are either headquartered in a foreign country or have offices here in Lafayette. And so we spend a significant amount of time with them. So, you know, it really is a good trip to have some of those conversations. I'll tell you, I've told people this before, some of the things that happen too is just the networking that happens between the folks in the groups while we're there. Even though I see Mayor Dennis and Commissioner Murtaugh a lot, it seems like we always find time to sit down and talk about additional things while we're there that we can don't always have the time to do here. And so overall, I think it's a very worthwhile trip. And I think the legislators appreciate the effort that we put in to go out there and spend some time with them.
Have you noticed any difference in the trips in the last couple of years as the changeover in administrations has happened? And I'm wondering if you're noticing any difference in the answers you get back from the federal lawmakers about what they're able to do in Congress, because there seems to be so much confusion at the federal level, not just between what's going on in the two houses of Congress, but indeed with their communications with the White House and the administration's priorities. Do you get any sense of that? And does that trickle down at all to what you're able to do on the local level with their help?
Well, I think there's probably two parts to that, two answers to that question, two parts. We do hear from folks while we're out there now that we hear more things like it's a very interesting time in Washington, D.C., or may say, you know, we're not exactly sure where that's going. You know, we have heard this and we have heard that, and we're not sure if we're that close. So I would say that I hear that just a little bit more.
Uncertainty.
Uncertainty about where things are going and maybe what was said today and what might be said tomorrow or what position that people might take. So I think we did hear a little bit more uncertainty. But with that being said, I think the neat thing for our community is that all of our legislators know that Tippecanoe County works together very well because regardless of political party, we work to get things done here. And so I think they realize when they're talking to us, it's maybe different that we know we're not a overly partisan group, and we're coming out there to find out how to get things done, not really for politics and how do we get things done in our community? How can they help us? And, you know, what some of the pathways that they might be able to guide us. And that's, you know, I think they realize that's what we're looking for. And so, you know, from the legislators themselves and the position that they've taken on issues over the years, that remained pretty consistent. I haven't seen a lot of change between what they believe and what they think and what they're working on. I think the difference that I saw is I'm not sure anybody really has a good feel for what direction for sure the White House is going on certain things. You know, just today, and I hadn't heard it, but I guess just today was announced really early this morning that at 3:30 this afternoon there's going to be a significant press conference on trade and tariffs, that
steel tariffs,
steel mm-hmm. and aluminum that might be coming out. And so I know everybody will be watching that, and just kind of the way that unfolded kind of looked like started with a tweet early this morning, maybe. You know, I think that does create some uncertainty for people and how legislators can respond and how they bridge that gap of communication to be able to work together in Congress to actually get things accomplished.
I think when people look at lawmakers on the local level, like you mayors going out there, I think there's a tacit thinking that you guys are asking things of the Congress people, whether you are or not. But I want to flip that idea on its head and ask, do the federal lawmakers ask anything of you municipal officials to take back to your communities, either things you can consider or actions you might take? Or do you ever get advice or maybe even directives from them on things they'd like to see you do?
You know, we do get asked questions. I don't know if I would call it a directive, but we do get asked questions where they might, you know, they'll say, what are your largest issues? What about this on workforce? You know, what do you think about this piece of opioid legislation, or what else could we do? And what do you see working or not working? You know, different things like that. And so there is that dialogue back and forth where they want to understand what's taking place in our community and what works and what doesn't. And we're pretty vocal about it. We were clear that we don't have any interest in the federal government flipping the road percentages that's 80-20 now to 20-80. I mean, we can't possibly, you know, on a local level, I think this is probably a good example, right? And that's why I'm elaborating a little bit. On a local level, our money comes from the federal government and the state government for us to do roads and motor vehicle highway funds. Locally, the only way that we really have to raise money for road work is through the what's called the wheel tax.
And just so people know what you're talking about, this is the $1.5 trillion proposal that the president laid out for infrastructure plan going forward.
Right. So, and we passed a wheel tax here about 6, 7, 8 years. Time gets away from me a little bit, but several years ago, that was a difficult decision, but we knew it needed to be done to try to keep up on the roads. But for the city of Lafayette, that only actually generates about $800,000 a year. Well, if you got to come up with 80% of a $20 million road project, which is not out of the question. Roads cost 5, 10, 15. I mean, we can't possibly generate that kind of money.
It's local. 20 times what you make in a year from wheel
tax. We don't have the capacity, or do we have statutory ability? So those kind of questions and hard discussions do take place while we're out there, and I think they're glad to hear that. And we, you know, those are important that we make our positions known on those issues.
I also saw that you had a meeting with Amtrak officials talking about the Hoosier State Line, which is, of course, something we've talked a lot about on this program. Tell me how that discussion went, because one of the things we keep hearing from local officials these days is on-time performance is not where we want it to be. It's gotten a little bit worse from its peak about 18 months ago. Tell me how those discussions went with the Amtrak folks.
Well, with the Amtrak folks, the discussions were cordial and went well. But the reality is, because we're all kind of on the same page, but the reality is I don't think we made much headway because we are dealing with the freight railway system. And I appreciate you putting that so politely on the last question. But the truth is the on-time performance has gotten dismal. I mean, it's not down just a little bit. It's down a significant amount. And, you know, people are not going to keep riding that train if it's hours late and if that on-time performance is as low as it is. And, you know, we talked to them about that. They agree. But until Amtrak and particularly CSX Railroad can reach agreements on how those trains are dispatched, you know, passenger rail is supposed to get the first right. And that's not happening in many places, and certainly not happening coming out of Chicago and out of Indianapolis and different things where the Hoosier State is involved. And there is a little bit of movement in Congress. I mean, it's my understanding from those meetings, there is a congressional law that says this is the way it's supposed to work, but it's not being enforced. And the Justice Department, at least at this point, has chose not to enforce that. And so the push right now with Amtrak is say, look, there's a mechanism in place that would take care of this, but it needs to be enforced. And, you know, we're going to continue to work with Amtrak to push that because we do believe that passenger rail is an important transportation mode for a progressive community, a community with a Big Ten world-renowned research university, people coming in from all over the world. We know it's an important transportation for people, Chicago to Indianapolis, for millennials. But it's got to be on time. It's got to be reliable. And we really need to get to, and we talked about this, and I think if it was on time enough and people could rely on it, it would work. You know, we really need the trains to leave in the morning, a train to leave in the morning, and a train to leave Chicago in the morning and pass, and the same thing in the evening, right? There needs to be, you know, I don't know, we need to have six or eight trains. People talk about that. Would that be fantastic? But you and I both know the chance in this community of making that all work financially, or the reality is probably not that good. But I think a train leaving each place in the morning and then a train leaving each place in the evening passing, I think that works. I think that's viable. I think that would greatly increase the number of people that would ride it because of the options that you have.
And the funny thing about all this is I think there seems to be general agreement on a lot of these things. There's agreement on that, I think. There's agreement that the law does, in fact, say passenger rail has the first priority. And so let me ask you, from your conversations with state lawmakers and your conversations with Amtrak and federal lawmakers, does it seem that we're getting toward a tipping point where – I mean, we've thought in the past couple of years – gosh, maybe this train is in trouble. I wonder, do you think we're getting to a point where it's going to have to be either the state government kicks in money like Governor Holcomb did for double tracking the South Shore up in the northern part of the state, or the federal government says we clearly need more money for Amtrak because, as has been well documented, Amtrak gets a tiny subsidy compared to what airlines get. Do you think we're getting to the point where, at least where this line is concerned, it's kind of put up or shut up?
Well, I mean, obviously, infrastructure improvements are important, but I'll tell you what Amtrak told us during this meeting, and I'm certainly paraphrasing this from memory, but basically what they told us was additional infrastructure would be helpful, different sidings for people to be able to pull off, things like that that would be able to increase speed. Absolutely would be helpful in the future. That would take a long time, even if you had the money today to do all that work. But what they actually said, the most single most important thing that needs to happen right now is just for the Justice Department to enforce that law on the freight railroads. That if that law was actively enforced and everybody followed the rules, the on-time performance would easily go back up into the 90 percentile range. It would be very, very reliable because, again, without getting into all the technical pieces, and I have to try to remember, and the way sidings work and how long they need to be and the speeds and all that, when you calculate all that, does it help? Yeah, but not even just a fraction of what it would mean for the passenger rail to actually get released first and to get the priority when they were coming through. And so that's really where the focus is right now, is getting the Justice Department to actually enforce that law.
Do you think there's any hope of that you've heard?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic, but that's about as best as I can honestly say right now from the meeting that we had. I know they're working on it. They want us to help, and all the communities along this route and other routes, to help be part of that message and ask us probably 20 times while we were in that meeting, please keep talking to your federal legislators about them helping put pressure to make this happen. I mean, I didn't leave there thinking it was impossible, but I certainly didn't leave there thinking it was imminent. But I did leave there pretty convinced from all the information, the data, all the stuff that they were able to show, that really is the biggest key and the thing that needs to happen first.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski today. Call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Email ask@wbaa.org and tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Let's get to a couple of questions that have come in from listeners. Rob writes, why does work on the Sagamore Parkway Bridge over the Wabash seem to be at a standstill? He says, we've had unseasonably nice weather the past few weeks, yet I don't seem to see a single worker there. I know that's an NDOT project, but do you have any updates that you get?
I have not received any updates from NDOT recently. Actually, when I leave this show, I sprint back across the river to go to a policy board meeting for the Area Plan Commission, and NDOT representatives will be there at that meeting. So I'll certainly ask that question here in just about an hour. But, according to the last thing I heard, they're still basically on schedule. They had inclement weather, flooding kind of calculated into all this. It may be a case, I know that we've had some good days, but we still had some pretty cold days. We've had some rain days. We've had days with rain and sunshine. I don't know if they're in the part of trying to pour concrete for the decking, and they need the temperature to get above a certain degree before they pour it or they can finish it out, particularly on that decking of a bridge that we all know needs to be just right. So, that's certainly a question I can ask here about 2 o'clock and try to get some information to your caller there.
All right. Another person wanted to know about a shooting that happened on the near south side of the city the other day. This person says, how do police determine the difference between a family feud, domestic violence, and criminal intent? I think they're probably getting at the police began an investigation and there was some talk about some sort of relationship and a lot of crimes, as we've mentioned on this show a number of times, a lot of crimes happen between people who know one another. It's not a lot of random crime. Mm-hmm. Can you give any insight into that either from your mayor time or from your previous career as a police officer?
Sure. I mean, I can't talk too much specifically about this individual case. As you know, it's still under investigation, and our detectives are gathering a tremendous amount of information and are working on it nonstop. But I can tell you that over time, people will come forward. We develop information that leads us to relationship connections, whether it is, as your caller accurately described, somebody in the family, some type of acquaintance, or is it some type of criminal associate that they are involved with in some type of criminal enterprise. And as you develop that information and you begin to talk to people, each person gives you a little bit here and there. Sometimes you get somebody that just kind of, for lack of a better term, spills their guts and, fills you in with a lot of detail at one time. But typically it's gathering pieces of information that you have to put together. And one of the things that I'd like to, remind listeners of and just kind of point out, the other thing that takes a tremendous amount of time is, and I'll be polite about this as possible, but the truth is lots of people lie to us. Right. So we get information and we cannot just take it on face value. So you spend a tremendous amount of time going out and trying to corroborate that information to see if it's true, factual, reliable, or, did you get the information and the information is correct, but the dates and times are all out of whack. And so you've got to try to figure out, well, why does that part not line up? This part makes sense, but the date and times don't line up. Or, well, the information's corroborated with what this other person said, but the location's off by, you know, 2 miles or something. And so they spend a tremendous amount of time corroborating that, because you just can't take, unfortunately, in many of these investigations, at face value what people are telling you. And so they, you know, when they prepare cases for court or to ask the prosecutor for a warrant, or the prosecutor to fill out the paperwork and the judge for the warrant, they've got to do that. So it takes a long time to do it well. I know it's frustrating for people involved. It's frustrating for the community, because we can't always release as much information as we would like. But to do it right takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of double checking.
On to other things, your city council has banned vaping, the use of electronic cigarettes, in places where smoking had already been banned. Why did that come to pass? How did you decide that now was the time to do that?
Well, Mr. Campbell, our city council member, brought that forward. That's something that he felt was important. He had saw studies and some documentation that vaping cigarettes is not as safe as people believe that it is. And he felt that it was important to promote a healthy community and send the right message that we ban that, along, as you said, you know, in accordance with our already smoking ban that was in place. Ironically, the day that they passed that, he did cite a new study that had just came out that morning, I guess, that really confirms to some of the actual chemicals that are in some of those vaping cigarettes and the potential side effects that they could have for people using them and people that would breathe that smoke. So I think it was a good move for the community. I certainly supported it, but it was Mr. Campbell's idea, but I certainly supported it and signed the change once they voted on it. And I think it's a good move. You know, the smoking ordinance itself, when we first did it, was extremely controversial. We packed the council chambers. We had numerous meetings. People were out in the hallways. And over time, I mean, I think if you tried to go back, it'd be just as bad. People wouldn't want to go back. It's worked out very well. Most places are smoke-free now. Even a lot of our bars are smoke-free now. And I think that's, you know, the direction that the community and the country's going.
No, I think that is broadly true, and I think the numbers suggest that. So I wanted to ask, do you think this is a step toward a complete smoking ban in Lafayette, much like what West Lafayette has? Because as you point out, there are still some bars and restaurants who do allow smoking in Lafayette. Do you think this is a step along the path toward a complete ban?
Well, I can't speak for the other city council members. I bet that is not something that I would bring up at this particular time. And I can't tell you that a council member might not. But, you know, I think our ban works well. There's only a very small number of bars left that even bars left that allow smoking. And so I think the ordinance for Lafayette has worked well and is achieving the goals that we hope that it would over time. And I think over time that number will even just on its own continue to shrink.
The council also did enact final passage of that Airbnb registration fee and registration website that you and I had talked about a couple of months ago. Do you have any sense of how that has progressed in terms of people responding to it, the other question I wanted to ask is, how is the city going to monitor whether people who are listing their rooms, especially if somebody just now decides to list a room on Airbnb, how do you keep up with the people who are the new listees to make sure they pay the registration fee?
Well, it really is kind of on the honor system, to be honest with you. I mean, we're hoping that people are aware of it and they'll come in. And we have said during the council hearings that we're not going to be out driving around trying to catch people. But if we do get complaints, then we will send the engineering department out to investigate that. And then at that time, we'll find out if people are registered. If they're not, we'll get them registered. And we're kind of hoping over time and actually, I appreciate you bringing it up, because it's important to kind of keep getting that message out, that over time, we'll get everybody registered and people will kind of know how the process works. I mean, our whole goal of that original ordinance was to just have something in place to help protect our R1 neighborhoods. I mean, we're not anti-Airbnb, and I think our ordinance was very fair. As you saw, the state people at Airbnb said they supported it, wouldn't fight against it.
And the state law that was just passed is very similar to your ordinance.
Right, because I had went down and testified in front of that committee over the summer when they were doing the summer study on it. They had said, hey, it looks like your ordinance kind of hit that common sense middle ground that we're looking for. So I had went down and testified before the committee that was studying that, and the lady that was in charge of Airbnb, I think I mentioned it before on the show when I walked out, said, hey, Mayor, you know, it's a good job. That's common sense. We're not opposed to something like that. So I think we're trying to do it right. We're not trying to be overbearing, still protect our R1 neighborhoods, and it'll kind of unfold, you know, over time. And if we have a mechanism now, at least if there is a problem, we have a way to address it.
In just our last couple of minutes, I wanted to note that your city and West Lafayette, now the county too, have joined this large class action lawsuit against opioid producers and distributors. What are you hoping to get from that? Is it money? Is it publicity about the problem? All of the above? What's your end goal there?
Well, I think, you know, I think as far as publicity about the problem goes, I think I feel like everybody in our community, the state, and the country really does understand the opioid crisis and what it means to our local communities, to our families, people that are losing children and loved ones. So I think as a nation, we understand that states and the federal government are working to try to do things, albeit still probably not a little too small for the magnitude of the problem, but we are making steps in that way. So our real goal is, and you know, I haven't been shy about this, is the opioid manufacturers and distributors, you know, that I feel played a role through marketing and information that they presented to the public and the doctors that helped create this problem. And I say helped create it. You know, they played a role in it. They need to help be part of the solution. And part of that solution is financial. This is a tremendous drain on local communities. When you look at what we're trying to do to increase addiction services, mental health services, I've talked recently about, you know, the police budget's up like $4 million. And most of all of that is directed towards drug interdiction, community outreach, adding people to street crimes, the drug task force, overtime, vehicles. There is a significant cost. So like I said, I've not been shy. They should play a financial role, and I'm hoping communities get funds. And as I said, we will use ours for education, to help educate people to try to stop this from happening before it does. Move money, if we can get it, to working with service providers for addiction services and mental health services, and then money for enforcement. It takes all of those to beat this problem. And like I said, our police budget's up over $4 million, and we could, you know, still like to be able to do more. And so I am hoping there is a financial piece to help compensate for what, you know, this situation has done to the community and helped solve the problem.
I was thinking about the tobacco lawsuits of a number of years ago. It strikes me this could be a modern day example of this playing out over a long period of time for you and other cities.
Well, the difference on this is, real quick, the way we filed it, we would get the money. The tobacco lawsuit, the state got all the money, and they did with it to what they thought. We feel local communities are better equipped to use that money in their own local communities.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We'll do it again next month.
Thank you, Stan.
And remember to listen at this time next week for our conversation with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. Send emails in advance of that program to our address, ask@wbaa.org. You can also tweet us at WBAA News on Twitter, and find all these shows archived at our website, wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.